up front on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thanks so much for joining us today on the show. So, a new report by the charity organization Oxfam regarding the state of global wealth inequality says that just over 2,000 of the world's richest people have more wealth than 4.6 billion people. And that figure represents around 60% of the planet's population. The Oxfam report titled A Time to Care warns that the inequality crisis continues to empower a wealthy elite as they accumulate vast fortunes at the expense of ordinary people, particularly poor women and girls. Other studies, including the UN World Social Report of 2020, shows that the income gap between the rich and the poor has been growing exponentially for the last 30 years. And even though the African continent has seen a remarkable economic performance in the last 15 years, the economic systems in place are such that the rich continue to accumulate vast amounts of wealth at the expense of the bottom 95% of the population. So on the show, we'll talk about some of the factors driving this inequality. I will talk to one of the authors of this new report, and we will get to hear some of your voices on this issue. Stay tuned. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
I am Barbara Kelvina Nafula from Uganda, specifically the eastern part of Uganda. When it comes to income inequality in Uganda, it's really a very big problem because income inequality is everywhere, but the gap in Uganda is really huge. It's really big. And if I'm to refer to the poverty map that was produced by the Uganda Bureau of Statistics, you find that region-wise, some regions are doing better than the others.
My name is Nicholas Rutaya. Income inequality, yes, it's a problem in our country, and the only way we can solve it is by distributing resources equally to all the areas of the country.
So many of us, the youth, are being affected by a lack of jobs. You find that recently there's been graduation, but you wonder where most of the graduates are going to go after. You ask yourself, what's next? So we need more of the hands-on if we are going to actually increase the income in our country and hence close up that gap.
Those were some of the voices sent in by our listeners on this topic, and we want to thank all of you for sending them. And for those of you who are just joining us, thank you for joining us. On the show today, we're talking about some of the factors that are driving the massive income inequality in Africa. And joining me via phone is Max Lawson, Oxfam's head of policy on inequality. He's also one of the co-authors of the Oxfam report titled A Time to Care. I reached him in Nairobi and started off by asking him the basis of Oxfam's calculations for this report.
Oxfam's calculations are based on the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Report that gives you an estimate of the wealth of the world's population, and then the Forbes list of billionaires. So we compare the two, as we have done in previous years, and it shows an extreme level of inequality where you have this tiny group of people, just over 2,000 people, mostly men, mostly white, sitting on top of it. Unimaginable amounts of money and having more wealth together than 60% of the world's population, which is about 4.6 billion people.
Now, part of the report says that the 22 richest men in the world have more wealth than all the women in Africa. What are the implications of this massive wealth gap?
Our main message this year is there is a connection between the extreme economic inequality, the gap between the super rich and the rest of us, and the gap between women and men, that this incredible wealth at the top of the global economy is built on the backs, on the work of hundreds of millions of women, women in Africa, women all over the world, working for free or working in poverty wages, poverty jobs, to support the global economy, and that all of the wealth they create in this sexist economy is being channeled upward into the bank accounts, the secret bank accounts of the super rich.
Now, how did many of these billionaires acquire their wealth? Is this something that we know? Or generally speaking, What are the factors that led to this level of inequality? And can anything be done about it?
The problem of super rich and the problem of the billionaires is a relatively new one. We've seen the number of billionaires double in the last 10 years. We've seen their wealth higher than it's ever been before. What that shows us is very recently, in recent times, we had much lower levels of inequality. We had much lower numbers of billionaires, which shows us that it's quite possible to have a vibrant and a successful global economy without this number of billionaires. And we would go further and say that, in fact, billionaires themselves are a sign of economic failure, not a sign of economic success. If we could instead take the wealth in their secret bank accounts and spread that around to redistribute, if we got them to pay their taxes as they should, just imagine the schools, the hospitals, the teachers, the nurses that that money could pay for. So we think that inequality is not inevitable. It's a policy choice. It's increased dramatically in recent years because governments have let it increase, and we think they could take steps to reduce the gap between rich and poor.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront or the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. We are speaking to Max Lawson, the head of policy on inequality. And Max is talking to us about the Oxfam report titled A Time to Care, that warns that there's an inequality crisis around the world, and that inequality crisis continues to empower a wealthy elite, a small wealthy elite, at the expense of women and girls and the other 99%. The report says that over just 2,000 of the world's richest people have more wealth than 4.6 billion people combined in the world. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. And as we do take this break, let's listen to your opinions.
I am Orlando Lunda. Income inequality has never been addressed by concerned civil and government organs. The idea of employing those who have achieved degree level of education has brought inequality on jobs. When you compare two working people like sales executives in different companies, you find payments differ. Income inequality in Kisumu town has resulted in slums coming up around the town, because workers are looking for low-charging houses to rent.
In terms of income, you find that most difficult jobs are given to the male, and that is why male are more developed than female. So I will just add that to the government or to the anybody, any support, to allow both sides and give them the chance.
My name is Daniel Bala Magaji. I think income inequality is a stage whereby you find one is richer than the other.
I see it as a disease that has eaten deep into my society.
There are a lot of poor people in Cameroon.
There's high level of poverty in Nigeria because there's no work, no food.
In my opinion, why some people are poor while some are rich or wealthy, this is what we call neo-colonialism.
Those were some of your opinions on our show today. Income inequality, what are some of the factors that are driving, that drive income inequality in Africa? This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Let's continue our conversation with Max Lawson, head of policy on inequality at Oxfam. Now, the Oxfam report was released ahead of the World Economic Forum. Can you explain to us the timing?
So the World Economic Forum is the biggest meeting of the super rich in the annual calendar and happens every January. So you've got well over 100 billionaires among many, many other multimillionaires, politicians, world leaders, going to this secretive mountain resort in Switzerland, where they like to think they can talk about solving the world's problems. So we use this moment to illustrate the scale of inequality in the world, and to make the strong point that the solutions to the world's inequality crisis are never going to come from the people in Davos. These are the people who caused the problem in the first place. The solutions to the inequality crisis lie on the street. They lie with ordinary people protesting, fighting for a fairer world. And we're seeing that all over the world, from Chile to Lebanon to France, ordinary people demanding that their politicians listen to them instead of listening to billionaires.
That was Max Lawson, Oxfam's head of policy inequality. He was speaking to me from the Kenyan capital in Nairobi. You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Chiatunga Rebecca Juna. I am a Ugandan and I'm in Kampala currently. Yes, there's a lot of income inequality alongside issues of gender and also issues of persons with disability. But also in terms of region, so it's a huge challenge. However, what we can do is ensure that there is gender equality in terms of equal pay. We find that some women, especially the grassroots women, are not getting their share of income. But we also find that there are challenges that will hinder them to be able to be paid efficiently. We do not take into consideration the issues of child care. There's unpaid domestic care work. But then look at also a young boy that is downtown carrying sacks on their head for only a dollar or a cent, because you find that they'll go away with 3,000 shillings a night. So that's how high it is, yeah. If they set a minimum wage bill, it means that we will be able to know that somebody cannot be employed below this amount, but also follow up in regards to issues of gender and also issues of inequality.
Welcome back, and for those of you who are just joining us, welcome. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. You can follow me on Twitter at Upfront Africa. I'm also on Instagram. Remember to check out our Facebook page. Just type in Upfront Show, like, subscribe, and send us a message. Let us know where you're listening in from. As we continue this conversation, let me bring back an old conversation that I had with Shaka Kanuma, a reporter in Kigali, Rwanda, on some of the issues around income inequality on the continent.
It's really shocking the contrast you see. I have not taken a statistical, but the anecdotal evidence is that you have too many poor people. The ratio of poor people to wealthy or well-to-do people is really shocking. When you walk into an African city and you look at the locomotion some of the people use.
Let's not even talk about locomotion. Let's talk about just the buildings. When you go into a city and you see a skyline or skyscrapers, and just right next to it there's a slum.
We'll even get away from the locomotion for a moment. Yeah. Now, in an African city, for example, you will... I don't know whether it's a case of incompetent bureaucracies, government agencies that don't even care about imposing standards, but you see some really, you know, terrible slums side by side with skyscrapers, gleaming glass structures that really look good.
Million-dollar houses.
Just a few kilometers away, you look at shacks and shanty towns and so on. And it's really incredible. Now, come to think of it, if you look at the Africa, public housing, for example, is almost non-existent. Well, at least in our part of the world. You only find people, rich people who can build their own houses. And then what passes for public housing is these slums, which are rent out to the poor folks who live in there. And they have no standard amenities as you'll find in the West. You'll find them cooking on charcoal or even on firewood in the city, mark you. So you just keep wondering, is this, what do we make of an African city? Is it an overgrown village or
an undeveloped city?
Is it a city in the actual sense of it? Because if you find people cooking with firewood or charcoal or whatever, but I suspect again, it's not a peculiar problem to Africa. Even India, have that kind of problem.
But what are some of the causes of such unfair resource distribution?
Listen, it's just obviously a function of badly run government. That's the main cause of this. Badly run governments don't mind if their people are in trouble economically, financially. They don't mind. Badly run governments only care for the few individuals who can sustain them, the ones they dole out patronage to, so that they are in power, and so on.
And also now, protecting status quo.
Yeah. But fortunately, again, we have a situation like Botswana, for example, which is totally different from most of the African picture. Mm. In Botswana, you have the beginning of a welfare state and a move towards more equitable distribution of national resources. And in Rwanda, the thinking is there. The money to do it in Rwanda, the wealth to do it in Rwanda is right now at the grassroots. I think they are building up. But the thinking that they have to be, you know, to distribute income to make sure that as wide a majority of the population as possible is into the, you know, is wired into the economy. The thinking is there.
That was Chaka Kanuma speaking to me on an earlier show that we did on income inequality. This is something that continues to be an issue around the continent, and even though the continent has made a lot of economic progress in the last 15 years, we see that income inequality continues to increase around the continent, particularly affecting women and girls.
On the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Richard Martin Smolki from Nigeria, Taraba State, Gembu, Federal Local Government. I'm enjoying your program. Thank you very much.
You know the money you take up, police. Me, I the love you, can.
Front of the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thanks so much for joining us. On the show today, we are talking about some of the inequality, some of the factors driving inequality in Africa. We just had your opinions on our topic of discussion. We also heard from Max Lawson, Oxfam Head of Policy on Inequality. And joining me in studio to further discuss some of the driving forces behind income inequality in Africa is Michael Motier, a young college graduate from the African Leadership University in Mauritius. Michael is also the founder of the Bridge Fund. He says that his organization strives to create quote, a thriving and sustainable middle-class African economy by building a financially inclusive ecosystem. In 2015, Michael was hosted as a game changer at the White House here in Washington, D.C. by former U.S. President Barack Obama. This was in recognition of Michael's leadership in driving change through education and mentorship in his community in Kenya. Michael, welcome to Upfront here on The Voice of America. Let me start off by asking you your opinion on this issue. What drives the income inequality, the massive income inequality that we see in your country, but also across Africa?
Income inequality is just basically driven by, in my opinion, the lack of access to opportunities, right? Whether you're a small business, entrepreneur in Nairobi, Kenya, and you're trying to go big in your business, you have, you know, a few issues that you're dealing with that are allowing you not to progress,
right,
and make, you know, a decent income. And among them, you have, you know, lack of capital, which is a classic one, and then you have lack of access to markets. And that is what I think cripples a lot of small business, owners in Africa. And I was doing a research myself, and Africa has, you know, roughly 1.2 billion people. And you have 80% of these people from sub-Saharan Africa relying and depending on small and micro enterprises.
SMEs.
But the problem is these SMEs, you know, on top of the lack of access to sufficient funding and lack of access to markets, these are some of the things that make it impossible for these people to make a decent living and support themselves, hence that inequality gap in the income.
Has income inequality gotten worse or has it gotten better? We know that most African countries have this target, this goal to be middle-income countries.
Mm.
And so many of them have set up programs, whether it's, you know, in terms of financial inclusion, a topic that you probably know much better than I do. Do you think that the prospect that were available to your parents, I'm not sure in what income bracket they were, but you think that it has gotten worse or it has gotten better in terms of, like, that social migration?
Mm. I think, yes, there are efforts to try and bridge that gap between, you know, the equality and inequality. But I think a lot more work has to be done, right? I agree that, you know, a lot of governments and the private sector have tried to come up with initiatives and projects to try and help, you know, especially small and micro enterprise business owners. But the formal financial institution settings still do not support a large majority of this SME ecosystem in Africa. You know, this is the mama selling, you know, vegetables by the roadside. And you have now even more increasingly people in formal employment having a side hustle, you know, what
to
they
be
call,
able to make up for,
which falls under the informal SME sector. So that tells you how big this, you know, segment is, and you know the capacity of what it can do for the continent and our economy.
So the question is then, what needs to be done for Kenya, known to have one of the most robust financial sectors? Why hasn't it responded to the SME issue, you know, providing funding to these
I think they've been doing that, and you know, I think financial institutions and governments across Africa have been trying to sort of help these SME business owners, but you know, you find that they are what banks consider high risk sort of clientele, and this is tied into a range of issues, you know, going back to things as simple as proof of address,
right?
So many of these people are moving around, they don't have the right, you know, KYC specifications or documentation, which makes it harder for a bank to give you a loan. And if, you know, you have one who's at least managed to get together these KYC things in check, the loans that they get from the banks are in such a way that, you know, the return times are too short. And
for them to make a profit.
For them to, make good of the money. So the bank gives you money this month, and next month they are knocking on your door asking for the first interest rate payment.
So I guess the banks need to come up with financial instruments to cater
for these people.
And I mean, 80% is, that's a big chunk of any market. Leave alone.
And it's a growing one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there non-traditional players in this financial sector that are coming up to try?
Oh, yes. And this is why we're seeing a lot more of the cryptocurrencies coming in, because they, you know, offer cheap access to capital and it's fast, it's secure, it's instant. And this, you know, eliminates a lot of what in the banking sector and the formal financial institution sector has to do that, because with cryptocurrency on the blockchain, to do a KYC is very simple, right? But if you're going through the banking way of doing KYC, you need a lot of documents. It takes time to prove that, hey, this is actually you. You need your ID. So as the world is evolving and becoming more digital, so is the way we, you know,
we deal with money and funding, access to money. Yeah, and right.
So you see a lot of this happening in Africa because, you know, the market is there and people are desperate to get access to these financial opportunities. Mm-hmm. But the formal institutions are not giving them that. So they resort to alternative means, which, you know, yes, they've been a lot of issues with it, but it's at least doing something to solve an urgent problem with urgent solutions.
Let's talk a little bit about something that goes back to education. I know we do want to have a quick conversation on education reform before I leave you, but financial literacy, you know, which I would say falls within both finance but also education.
That's
people
right.
People not knowing money, how to handle money, how to look for money, how to access some of those financial instruments that might be available to them that they don't even know.
They don't know. That's right.
How important is it that for people to start learning about finances at what age?
I think as early as you know, someone understands anything within the education space. And I think countries like, you know, the U.S., we see a lot of, you know, parents taking time to make sure they instill an education and financial literacy in their kids. And it's part of them growing up. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see a lot of the young, you know, U.S. or, you know, other developed countries doing great things at such a young age, because this has been infused in the educational system. And like, you know, taking the example of Kenya, I don't remember any point in time through my primary, secondary, high school, and even college where I was taught how to deal, you know, how to deal with money.
Growing up, money was for grown-ups. Anything that has to do with money.
You don't think about it. you use it, spend it.
Your interaction with money was when they give you money to go buy something on the at the store, and then you bring back the change.
Yes.
And that was it. That was the end of it.
And you go all the way to college, you're 25, 26, and you're still, you know,
absolutely.
You're still
the first time you actually handle money that is your own is when you get that first paycheck,
and you don't know what to do with it. Yeah. So I think it should be infused into our systems, especially now speaking about Kenya and African context. As early as primary, there are instruments that can be used to teach young kids, you know, how to be more responsible with money. Mm. And we've seen these systems and instruments being implemented in countries like the US, in Finland, and in other, you know, developed countries. And we see the difference in how the kids grow.
Absolutely.
And how eventually when they get into leadership, whether in business or government, how they deal responsibly with the resources they have.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But on the other hand, back home, there's a long way to go. And I think, you know, the internet is also making it possible now for young people to access this kind of education online.
Mm.
And hence we now, you know, are able to see a lot more young people being responsible with, you know, how they make money, how they, you know, spend money, and when they get into businesses or spaces of leadership, the impact is felt.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Michael. That was Kenya's Michael Mutie, a young college graduate from the African Leadership University in Mauritius. He just graduated this year. Michael is also the founder of the Bridge Fund. He says that his organization works to create a thriving and sustainable middle-class African economy, and they do this by building a financially inclusive ecosystem. And we want to thank you, all of you who sent in your opinions on this topic. This is a topic of great concern around the world, but especially in Africa. And if you want to continue our conversation, go on our page at voanews.com/upfront. Let us know what you think about the show. You can also follow us on our social media platforms. My Twitter handle is @upfrontafrica. That's also my Instagram handle. Our Facebook page is @upfrontshowvoa. Just type that in and you find the show. Remember to click like, subscribe, and share with your friends. We'll catch you next time right here on The Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye, everyone.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on the Voice of America.